This is Understanding Israel-Palestine. I am Jamie Jackson. May 14th, 2023 marks the 75th anniversary of the Nakba. Al-Nakba is the Arabic word for catastrophe, the name given to the dispossession of Palestinians in 1948 by Zionist militias who violently seized their land to create the circumstances for Israel's declaration of independence. The view that the Nakba continues to this day has been dramatically borne out in recent weeks by multiple events. In October, Ben-Gvir, now the Minister of National Security, in charge of supervising Israel's police force, drew his gun in a Palestinian neighborhood in East Jerusalem and told Jewish Israelis at the scene, on camera, to shoot Palestinians. In late February, in what has been called a pogrom, Israeli settlers torched the Palestinian village of Huwara in one of the worst attacks the region has seen in years. Since the start of 2023, Israeli settler-related violence has averaged 3 incidents per day. In this episode, the fourth of our Nakba project, we listen to portions of a discussion among the 3 authors of a new book, Protecting Human Rights in Occupied Palestine, Working Through the United Nations. Each of the authors served as a UN Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territories occupied since 1967. John Dugard, South African Professor of International Law at the Universities of Cambridge and Leiden from 2001 to 2008. Richard Falk, Professor Emeritus of International Law at Princeton University from 2008 to 2014, and Michael Link, Associate Professor at the Faculty of Law, Western University from 2016 to 2022. They explain how actions by the United States at the United Nations have obstructed all attempts to hold Israel accountable for its continuous and widespread violations of international law and human rights. Richard Falk begins by explaining why they wrote the book.
I guess the fundamental motivation was the sense that the continuities of our experience within the UN system and the author of these annual and semi-annual reports, it made sense to seek a broader audience to expose our experience within the UN system to a larger group of activists, intellectuals, publicly concerned individuals around the world by showing through the documentary evidence of the reports themselves that we had a coherent, evolving portrayal of something that was imposing terrible suffering on the Palestinian people, and which the organized international system seemed helpless to address. The UN context is important, but it's not able, without the mobilization of civil society, to transform the situation. And without transforming the situation, the terrible experiences of the people living under Israeli occupation will grow even worse as the recent elections and the new government seem to demonstrate. In one sense, because of this intensification of wrongdoing on Israel's part, the book is more timely than we thought it might be.
Perhaps because Professor Dugard was the first special rapporteur, he was given access to Israel, whereas the other two were banned.
It's important to distinguish my position from that of Richard and Michael, because I was the only one who was allowed into the occupied Palestinian territory. Richard was arrested when he arrived on his first mission and was deported. On the other hand, I was allowed into the occupied Palestinian territory and given access to the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza. I was special rapporteur during the Second Intifada, so it was a period of armed conflict. Despite that, I was allowed to travel freely throughout the occupied Palestinian in a UN vehicle with UN experts. And so my reports were based largely on personal observations and on discussions I had with Palestinians and UN officials and NGO officials. I had access to President Arafat on a number of occasions during my period as special rapporteur. He was blacklisted, as it were, by the West, and no foreign visitor from a Western country would visit him. So that meant that I had easy access to him, and we met on many occasions, which gave me special insights.
Professor Dugard was asked what he might say to President Biden.
I think I would start by describing the fact that both apartheid South Africa and the situation in occupied Palestine is based on institutionalized race discrimination. And I would give examples of this the discrimination when one sees it in respect of freedom of movement, the military courts, which are used to deal with Palestinians, clearly violate fair trial standards and constitute discrimination against Palestinians. The use of force against Palestinians is completely discriminatory. Israeli settlers are not subjected to the same rules. So there is a clear pattern of discrimination. And then I would emphasize that the other aspect of apartheid in South Africa was that of political repression, and that one sees that in Palestine as well. Civilians are killed, militants are tortured and killed, and generally the IDF has been more brutal in its handling of the situation than the South African forces were during the apartheid period. And then I would go on to stress the fact that the United States refuses to accept that apartheid applies in Israel, because Israel is seen as a special friend, and that Joe Biden is motivated by Holocaust guilt because the United States did not behave particularly well towards Jews during the 1930s, that he's influenced by IPAC and the Israeli lobby. And finally, he is reluctant to confront the issue of apartheid because he is afraid of being accused of anti-Semitism.
Well, I think the first point that is important to recognize is that the UN was designed not to be effective when the veto powers, the five winners in World War II, were not in agreement. And the fact that the United States has so consistently supported Israel in the only decision-making organ of the UN really justifies the conclusion that that the UN is an organization for states, but it is subject to what I call the primacy of geopolitics. In other words, where one of these veto powers, or what used to be called great powers, has a strong strategic interest in nullifying international institutional behavior, it has the means to do so. And no state more than my own, the United States, uses that leverage to protect Israel and to insulate it from censure. And I would say that it's not a question of convincing Biden. He knows the reality. It's a matter of identifying the strategic international interests and his domestic ambitions that lead to such a strong identification with Israel, where he says, "I'm a non-Jewish Zionist," something no other political leader in the United States has gone quite that far. And in the face of what Michael was saying about the authoritative findings in civil society, that it's an apartheid regime. He knows all that. And yet.
Once Professor Dugard began filing his reports with the UN, he found little support there.
What I found was that on many occasions that senior members of the UN Secretariat expressed support for Israel. For instance, the undersecretary, members of the Secretariat of the United Nations were obstructing accountability. And I found that when I was a special rapporteur, that I was told by Mr. Prendergast's successor, Lynn Pasco of the United States, that I should not criticize the United States because as special rapporteur, I was a member of the United States. And I said, well, I wasn't paid by the United States and I didn't see why I should be loyal to the United States. So I think that one has to face the fact that the West has been largely responsible for failure to hold Israel accountable. Ending of the occupation is to be found not in Jerusalem or Tel Aviv, but in Washington and London and Berlin.
Professor Link explains his eventual decision to focus his report on apartheid.
When I was appointed to this job, I explained in the midst of various criticisms about what I'd written previously on Palestine. I said, I come into this with an open mind, but I don't come into this with an empty mind. At the very beginning, I certainly was concerned about the issues of the attacks that were on me, but I realized these arguments or these attacks had no basis or grounding in fact, no grounding in law, no moral core to them. And I figured the best thing I can do as special rapporteur is to write as solid a report as I can based on the facts and based on the law. When I was appointed as special rapporteur in 2016, absolutely the last thing in my mind was that I was going to utter the word apartheid or devote a report to apartheid during the 6 years. In my view, in 2016, all I needed to do was to emphasize the framework of international humanitarian law, the framework of international human rights law, because this was so well embedded in countless UN resolutions. But I thought all I had to do was go to diplomats, go to policymakers, go to senior political decision makers, explain the framework they'd already voted for and say, why aren't you doing more? And so I spent my first 5 years as special rapporteur emphasizing the violations, that the settlements were illegal and indeed a war crime under the Rome Statute, that the annexation, either de facto or de jure annexation, was illegal. The location of the wall was illegal. The human rights trends were getting worse, and they were all violations of human rights obligations that were owed by Israel to the Palestinians, and so on. And I didn't get very far. You know, I think I had a great deal of influence with respect to civil society. There were certain countries that I think paid great attention to my reporting. But in terms of moving the needle, I didn't see it moving very much. And before my eyes, during the first 5 years that I was special rapporteur, you know, the occupation was deepening. It was getting more embedded. The levels of violence in order to maintain the occupation were increasing. And while the framework of international humanitarian and human rights law was important, and continues to be important, this was no longer an ordinary occupation. This was an occupation that was going from occupation, going on the passing through the last exit off the highway, past annexation, and was now heading into apartheid. And I began to grapple with this issue. I said I had by the end of the fifth year, I was saying I have to address the issue of apartheid. And I was not the first one to say it. Obviously, I had the benefit of both John Dugard's writings with respect to comparing Israel and South Africa. I had the benefit of Richard's wonderful report that he co-authored with Virginia Tilley. And I also had the benefit that the mind of the international and regional human rights community, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, Beth Salem, Al-Haq, among many others, were already now writing comprehensive reports on apartheid. So it seemed to me that first of all, the analysis of framework of the laws of occupation was no longer adequate to describe or proscribe what was going on there. But the second thing was, obviously, you know, there was so clearly a two-tier system of political and legal rights that were being parceled out depending on race, nationality, and ethnicity. And if you can find a better word in the international vocabulary than apartheid to describe that situation, you know, please tell me. But there isn't. I've looked and I can't find it. So my last report last March of 2022, I delivered to the Human Rights Council on the issue of apartheid. While I said, you know, we get the origins, obviously, of the framework of apartheid and the meaning of apartheid from the practices between the 1940s and the 1990s in Southern Africa, that's not our analytical starting point. Our analytical starting point is the legal definition of apartheid that's found in the 1973 International Convention on Apartheid and the 1998 Rome Statute on Apartheid. Think of this. There's a comprehensive definition that the international community that created the 1998 Rome Statute on the International Criminal Court established. This is 4 years after the end of political apartheid in South Africa. So in putting in a comprehensive definition of apartheid into the 1998 Rome Statute, the international community is looking forward to saying, apartheid cannot happen again. It is a crime against humanity. So with that forward-lookingness, it says apartheid could happen in other situations. It doesn't have to be exactly the same as in South Africa. We don't have, for example, in Palestine, separate water coolers, separate entrances into buildings, separate benches and parks that say white and non-white. But in many ways, as John Dugard and Richard Falk have laid out, the application of this separateness in Palestine between Israeli Jews and Palestinian Arabs is in many ways much worse than it was in Southern Africa. So for all those reasons, I then focused on writing my last report on apartheid. And when I introduced my report in late March 2022, I had a 10-minute introduction to speak to the Human Rights Council in Geneva. And I said, if the international community had taken the laws and the resolutions that it had created with respect to the supervision and the governance of the Israeli occupation of Palestine seriously 45 years ago or 35 years ago, when it first started passing en masse these resolutions, then I wouldn't be here today in 2022 delivering a report on apartheid. But because you've essentially let impunity reign with the Israeli governance of its occupation, what originally became violations of the laws of occupation has now transformed itself into an embedded state of apartheid. The only regret I have is that I didn't say it earlier.
Professor Falk explains that Israel's brutality against Gaza is meant to send a message to Palestinians and to Iran. He shares his conclusion that Israel has shifted tactics, choosing now to accuse critics with anti-Semitism to silence them.
I would say that John gave a very good background for this periodic excessive violence that was directed at Gaza and was particularly destructive and cruel because it targeted a crowded, impoverished territory where the civilian population was essentially trapped in what was widely known as the largest open-air prison in the world. It was part of my period that it became clear that Israel was using Gaza as a way of conveying to the rest of the Arab world and to Iran that it would spare no violence if its interests were being challenged. In other words, Gaza became a kind of combat zone model for Israel, what one might call Israeli Prussianism, using military power to extinguish claims of human rights or claims of elementary social justice. The one thing that John didn't mention that I think was important in both our period was the continuous extension of the settlements, despite the clarity of the prohibition of such arrangements in occupied Palestine in Article 49 of the Fourth Geneva Convention. And they were not only the settlement expansion was not only important, but it sent a contradictory message to the world and to the Palestinians that you don't establish this kind of settlements if you have any seriousness about a peace process that involves some kind of political compromise with respect to territorial sovereignty. So it was important beyond itself as a symbol of what the Zionist project really became. which was a one-state Israeli solution. And the settlements were the first way of establishing this understanding. And the only other things I'd say was that consistently in administering the OPT, Israel relied on various forms of collective punishment. Again, completely contradicting Article 33 of the Fourth Geneva Convention, and making the lives of ordinary Palestinians difficult on a daily basis, more than difficult, intolerable on a daily basis. And finally, the tampering with Palestinian residents in East Jerusalem was part of the Israeli continuous ethnic cleansing that had gone on since the establishment of Israel in 1948 and the Nakba and the coercive departure of as many as 700,000 Palestinian civilians. That's been a continuous process carried on in various ways, and now I believe is at the point of a new inflection, a new inflection point where a more visible effort to upset Palestinian residents is concerned and engage in a renewed process of expulsion. I would say this, that it's less a matter of talking truth to power than talking truth. In other words, I don't think, at least speaking for myself, I thought that my government or even the upper echelons of the UN were a particularly receptive audience. And I thought my task was to be as one of informed impartiality and to use what evidence I could gain access to make a convincing case as to what the Palestinian people were experiencing as a consequence of Israeli policies and practices. I would say that in the background of my own experience, probably less so than John and Michael, was this weaponization of anti-Semitism. It wasn't so much, I think, a genuine accusation or an expression of belief, but it was a way of changing the conversation so that instead of focusing on the message, you focus on the messenger and whether that messenger has credibility or not. And just one final one further point is, I think John, by having the benefits of access, did such a good job that he prevented his successors from having access. In other words, by truthfully reporting, that was, from an Israeli point of view, harmful. And they shifted tactics in that period from, they had earlier tried to respond substantively to criticism. As the situation worsened and became more extreme, they shifted to this kind of diversionary tactics of blaming the UN as biased and blaming those who served as biased and forgetting that what was being reported was being reported by professional observers doing the best job they could do.
Professor Dugard sees the weaponization of anti-Semitism as a tactic that had not been available for South Africans defending apartheid.
The difference between civil society in respect of South Africa and civil society in respect of Israel relates to the weaponization of anti-Semitism. It's very, very difficult for political leaders to confront Israel because they will be identified as anti-Semitic immediately. So that explains the fact that in many European countries, opinion polls show that the majority of the population is highly critical of Israel and tends to support Palestine, but the political leadership nevertheless supports Israel. And I think one has to confront this weapon of anti-Semitism, which is being used by Israel to defend itself. And that is the main distinction between South Africa and Israel, that South Africa had no weapon of this kind to defend itself.
Professor Falk sees a benefit in the symbolic role of the UN Special Rapporteur reports.
I make a distinction between the substantive inability of the UN to act in a situation of this kind where it's up against such formidable geopolitical blockage, and its symbolic role in convincing civil society in particular of the difference between right and wrong, or lawful and unlawful. And in this symbolic domain, the UN has an enormous influence. And I think our role and this book are indications of what the UN can do, and also the limits on what it's able to do. And it just can't, without the mobilization of civil society in a strong way, the intergovernmental system, as reflected in the UN and the most influential states in the world, has shown an unwillingness to protect the human rights of the Palestinian people. And so in a way you can view this effort of ours as one of filling a normative vacuum, that is, of providing a kind of push toward accountability that the actors that have that real formal responsibility are unable and unwilling to follow through about.
You have been listening to a discussion of the book Protecting Human Rights in Occupied Palestine, Working Through the United Nations, as the three authors reflect on their experiences as former UN Special Rapporteurs. Events all over the world will commemorate the May 14th anniversary of the Nakba. If you would like to join a working group in the Greater Kansas City area to plan an event, you can reach us through our new website, www.voicesmadevisible.com. There you can also find more information about Palestinian efforts to realize freedom, dignity, and justice, and share your thoughts with us. This is Understanding Israel-Palestine. I am Jamie Jackson. Thank you for listening.